Locked On NBA, the biggest stories, the local experts. Every Monday, we dig into the biggest stories in the NBA with the Locked On Podcast Network hosts. Today, we'll stop in San Antonio to speak with Jeff Garcia of Locked On Spurs about how San Antonio got a Game 1 victory over Denver in Denver. We'll go to Josh Bass of Locked On Nets to talk about Brooklyn stealing their Game 1 against the Philadelphia 76ers. And then we'll go to Tony East of Locked On Pacers about how Indiana succumbed to Boston's pressure in Game 1 and what the Pacers can do without their best player to try and steal this series off Boston. It's all coming up, the biggest stories with the local experts on Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hi guys, and welcome to another week of Locked On NBA. It's NBA playoffs time, of course. I am your host, your Monday host, Josh Lloyd. I'm also the host of the Locked On Fantasy Basketball Podcast and the lead analyst at basketballmonster.com. You can find me on Twitter at redrock_bball. The first lot of games in the NBA playoffs are done, so we're going to be covering a few of those stories across the league with some big upset victories across the NBA. So let's get to it. Now, let's bring in a man who's not only the host of the Locked On Spurs podcast, but also Greg Popovich's backup sommelier. It is Jeff Garcia here to talk about the San Antonio Spurs' big upset victory in the Game 1 of their playoff series against the Denver Nuggets. Jeff, I know that you're an optimist regarding the Spurs, as so many Spurs fans are, but the way that game played out, was there an element of surprise to you as to how San Antonio was able to almost dominate Denver the majority of that game?
I guess the only big surprise is the fact that the Spurs actually won on the road. As you know, Josh, this season, or this past regular season, the Spurs have been pretty bad away from the AT&T Center. So for them to go into the Nuggets gym, a place they have not won all this season, and as a matter of fact, the last time they went to Denver, they got thumped. So for them to come out and play a balanced game, what I mean by that is, you had DeMar DeRozan struggling 35% shooting for the game. LaMarcus Aldridge 31% shooting for the game. But to see guys like Bryn Forbes, Derek White especially, Rudy Gay, even a guy like Davis Bertans, who hit a key three when the things were getting really tight, step up in a game where the Spurs had to have it. Look, the Spurs don't have home court advantage. They now have home court advantage. I think that's huge because the Spurs have the second best home record this past season. So not only do you steal home court advantage away from the Nuggets, you see guys step up when the two main stars are having bad shooting nights. This should spell trouble not only for the Nuggets moving forward, but if they advance. LaMarcus Aldridge said it best after the game. He said it doesn't matter if he scored 30 points or if he didn't, and obviously he didn't, but he said it's so important for the team to get the win because it showed how much balances on this team. So A, yes, I am surprised they got a road win, and B, I'm kind of not, because the Spurs experience in playoff situations towers over Denver's.
We've heard so much about this Spurs team, your lack of shooting, and you did highlight those two main guys, DeRozan and Aldridge, not hitting their shots, but everyone else hit their shots at a tremendous rate. Derek White shot 70%, Bryn Forbes at 67%, Rudy Gay shot 67%, Patty Mills didn't take many shots, but he hit them. The team shot 47% from three overall, albeit only on 15 attempts, but they made those shots. The high-volume guys didn't hit theirs, but everyone else stepped up, and it looks like a very regular season type of rotation from Popovich. There only one guy playing big minutes, and that's DeRozan with 39. Derek White limited to 28 minutes. Bryn Forbes only playing 30 minutes as Pop. Really just that bench that kept this team alive so many times this season when starters had struggled with shots, and guys like Ballinelli and Mills that would come in and rescue them from time to time. It was just more of the same there, of that bench really is still providing not the same level as the starters, but an elevated level compared to most benches across the NBA.
Yeah, and the Spurs not only did that, they also contained Nikola Jokic as best they could. Yeah, he finished with a triple-double, but they really were swarming him. They were really making life difficult for him. He only took 9 shots, and but the Spurs, I think that was a right game plan to double Jokic as often as they did. And although, you know, again, he had a triple-double, but it wasn't a big triple-double. 14 points, I'm sorry, 10 points for Nikola. You know, that's well below his average. Yeah, he hurt San Antonio on the assist and rebounding. But when you hold Nikola Jokic to 10 points, I think the Spurs win that matchup. And yeah, I mean, maybe it canceled out with LaMarcus Aldridge having a bad night. But it just goes to prove that this Spurs, maybe they're just a little deeper than Denver. And maybe that experience, a playoff experience they have over the Nuggets is just going to be a huge factor moving forward. At one matchup that I don't think got a lot of attention heading into the series, and I've been mentioning it quite a bit leading up to the series, has nothing to do with the players, has everything to do with the coaches, Pop versus Malone. I think you're going to see that battle really be highlighted as the series continues. Look, Malone is going to say what he has to say after the game when he said that he expects this team to go to game three tied up. Tied up 1-1. He has to have that confidence to leak into his team. But I think he's a serious disadvantage. Pop has been there and done that. He has 5 NBA titles to his name, Coach of the Years awards. He's going to throw different looks at Malone, and it's up to Malone to match that. And quite frankly, I don't think he does, and he can.
Yeah, look, it's pretty hard for any coach to match up to what Greg Popovich can do based on his talent, his experience, his championship pedigree. That's going to be tough for any coach, but I do agree. Obviously, the Spurs do have that coaching advantage here. One last thing I do want to touch on you here with Jeff is the play of Derek White. His first playoff game, starting at point guard, I thought he was fantastic for the majority of the season. Down towards the April, end of March period of the year, he did tend to fade a little bit. The shots weren't going in. Pop was pulling his minutes back. Now, I don't know if that was Pop pulling his minutes back because he was struggling or it was a management type of thing because he had dealt with those heel issues through the season a couple of times. But he came out, he absolutely exploded in his first playoff game.
Yeah, Derek White was the MVP for game one. Not only did he pretty much embarrass Paul Millsap with that tremendous dunk in the beginning of the second half. This is the play of Derek White for me wasn't that too surprising in the sense that he has been doing that towards, after the All-Star break. Look, when he was banged up and was without the team during the rodeo road trip, the team felt his loss. They were 7-7 without him. DeMar DeRozan kept on saying they need him back. Popovich said that this team is discombobulated without White. And he steadies this team. They don't have a true point guard because of the situation with DeJounte Murray. I mean, obviously, he's a wash for this season and won't be back till next year. But that's it. They don't really have a true point guard. Bryn Forbes, he's not one. Patty Mills, he's not one. DeMar DeRozan, he's been seen with a ball in his hand. Obviously, he's not a point guard. That only means Derek White. That's how important he is. And what astonishes me is that this is just his sophomore season. And his rookie season, majority of that was in the Austin Spurs G League and barely got any minutes in his rookie season with the San Antonio club. So for him to be thrown into the fire the way he was because of the situation at the point guard spot just speaks volumes of the development that the Spurs put into White and the other players too, like Forbes and Bertans. But in particular, White, to see what he is doing in just his second season is just tremendous. He's been playing great for San Antonio. I think the Spurs have something good with him. And to scratch the surface of what his peak can do, and when he's paired with Murray next season, that's a great problem to have here, San Antonio, what to do with two point guards, of that caliber. So Derek White, he's humble even after the game when he was just talking about the mistakes he did. He said that he couldn't get past that. LaMarcus Aldridge spoke about that after game one, saying that Derek White's biggest thing is that he can't let go of errors that he does. But I think that's a good thing. That just shows the level of his maturity on the court. And it's not just simply that dunk he had and the numbers. He had a key defensive moment late in the game, stealing the ball from, I believe it was a Murray, to ice the game for San Antonio. All in all, great on both ends. And this is just the peak of his abilities. I hate to see when he reaches his breakout season, because I don't know if this is his breakout season.
He's been fantastic, obviously, throughout the regular season. But here, in game one, a key driving force for the Spurs, getting that victory. They go back to Denver, or they stay in Denver for game two, really looking to tighten the screws on the Nuggets and get that game two victory. Jeff will have that covered for you all over on Locked On Spurs. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Every time, Josh. Talk to you later.
Don't forget, guys, to subscribe to this podcast by using the new Himalaya podcast app. Go and subscribe over there and download it from your app store, and then subscribe to Locked On NBA as well as all of the podcasts across the Locked On Podcast Network. All right, now it's time for us to talk to a man who is the host of the Locked On Nets podcast and also doubles as Damari Carroll's stylist. It is Josh Bass. Josh, a very happy time in Nets fandom to be joining the show here as Brooklyn steals the game one in Philadelphia against the Sixers. How happy are you, but is there any level of surprise? How much doubt did you have going into that game? Is that a pleasant surprise, or was it something that you thought, yeah, we've got a real chance here?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm definitely euphoric after the game. I think, to be honest, after the initial kind of news came out with Embiid saying he was going to be doubtful for game one, I was pretty optimistic about their chances. Obviously, 20 minutes before the game was starting, Cassidy Hubbard got news that he was going to play, and really my hopes just kind of crashed from there. I said, oh, what is this? I was sure that they were trolling us, something was going on. But even with Embiid in there, the Nets really just did an incredible job. Their game plan on guys like Embiid, Ben Simmons, J.J. Redick was terrific. I thought Kenny Atkinson clearly outcoached Brett Brown in this one. And just with the performance they had, I think the Nets didn't really necessarily play their absolute A game, but did a good job. The game plan was great, and getting a win on the road, really looking to take advantage of a Philly team where they are clearly not living up to the sum of their parts when you look at all the top talent they have.
I think, yeah, there's obviously plenty of impressive things here in this Nets victory, but the fact that Jarrett Allen was limited to just 10 minutes, their starting center, and we had Ed Davis come in and pick up the slack. We had a huge game from Caris LeVert coming off the bench. Jared Dudley did his thing, didn't fill up the box score, but played a lot of minutes and was important there. Yeah, just how important is the fact that they've just got this deep, and people talk about depth in the regular season, oh, that's great, it wins you games, but when it comes to the playoffs, it doesn't matter. But we've seen, especially in this game, we saw it with the Spurs bench providing you great value in their victory against the Nuggets, that maybe that narrative is not 100% being turned on its head, but the Nets are able to change that around. So we've got quality guys 10 deep, 11 deep here that we can use, and that could make a difference here.
Yeah, no, they really have the ability to kind of mix and match every style. They have a guy like Jared Allen where if they're playing a team that really goes to the basket a lot and they need that weak side rim protection, he's kind of their man for that. If they need a junkyard guy, it's Ed Davis. If they need small ball, Jared Dudley, they can play every single style. And I think that's the biggest key with this team. You mentioned Jared Allen just got completely neutralized against Joel Embiid. He just doesn't have the size or the strength to go up against him. We saw that in the regular season. I don't think he's going to be too much of a factor this series, but the Nets have shown they can still get by otherwise, just with the amount of guys they have and the really great game plans that Kenny Atkinson has been able to devise. And, you look at this team, they're pretty small when it comes to their kind of forwards and their bigs, but their guards are huge. You have Caris LeVert, D'Angelo Russell, Joe Harris, Spencer Dinwiddie. Those guys, if they're on a switch against a bigger player, can definitely compete. And I think that's the key to a lot of their defensive success.
I think with this team, we look at this sort of performance, but it's great and it's fantastic to get this victory and switch home court advantage back to Brooklyn. But one thing I don't think we can ignore, Josh, is the fact that the Sixers shot 12% on their threes. The Nets shot 42%. You, not even if you flip those numbers or if you even those numbers out, then the game probably looks a little bit different. So I think we do have to look at the fact that the Sixers couldn't hit any threes at all. And if you just look at that number, that 12%, that's obviously really low. But how much of that is the Sixers just missing shots? How much of that is the defensive scheme Kenny Atkinson's putting out there, the extra pressure he put on someone like J.J. Redick, for example? You've got to expect some level of a bounce back, but with the way that the Nets defended the three and put that pressure on, do you think that they can keep the Sixers to a lower outside percentage that they normally would shoot?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be some regression to the mean for both of these teams. But Josh, the one thing I'll say is that the Sixers didn't have just a ton of open threes that they missed. I mean, there was a couple from Mike Scott, a couple from J.J. Redick that didn't go in. But for the most part, their 25 attempts, a lot of them were contested. And you look at the Sixers team, they don't really have much three-point shooting besides JJ and Mike Scott and Tobias Harris. It's really those three that are the most consistent. Jimmy Butler can definitely hit a decent number of threes, and Embiid's super inconsistent. We all know that Ben Simmons is not a three-point shooter whatsoever. So I think the Nets' three-point defense was really good in game one. I don't expect the Sixers to go 12% shooting every game. That's just not going to happen. In addition, Philly's free throw shooting was pretty poor, and the Nets' free throw shooting was amazing, and that could have led to the differential as well. But I think that the Nets' three-point defense is going to be big throughout the series, but I do think they'll be able to limit the Sixers to a pretty poor percentage.
Yeah, look, that's going to be key, that free throw, yeah, like that, because the Sixers got to the line 42 times as opposed to the Nets 26, but hit just they hit just 29 of those 42 attempts, whereas the Nets went 24 of 26. It is a big difference when you hit your free throws. And those two things, free throw shooting and three-point shooting, if they just even out to even to their regular season averages, then you could be talking about a different result. But yeah, the free throw percentage maybe not as much. It can be influenced by the opponent. But yeah, what the pressure they put on Redick, yeah, limiting him, getting him to foul out, only taking those four threes is really important. Plus, as you mentioned, the lack of three-point shooting that is on this Sixers team. You're just shutting down those guys who can shoot them does really limit their opportunity in those areas. What did you make of D'Angelo Russell's first playoff game? Obviously led the team in scoring 26 in just 29 minutes. It was relatively inefficient during that time, but in terms of leadership and his first showing on the big stage, how did you think D'Angelo performed?
Yeah, I thought he had a really nice game. And as you said, he struggled a lot in the first half, especially. I think he was only 2 of 11 from the field, couldn't get a shot or early on. And I think those first 5 or 6 minutes of the game was pretty unwatchable from both sides. It was a foul fest, and also the Nets couldn't hit a shot besides Joe Harris. But D'Lo really got going in the second half, 19 points for him. It was pretty efficient with his shooting, only 4 assists. But I think a lot of that has to do with the Nets' game plan and that they wanted D'Lo, LeVert, Dinwiddie to just keep going ISO ball as soon as they got a favorable mismatch, whether that was on a big man, whether that was JJ Redick. So he purposely didn't have a lot of assists, but you could tell how confident he was. I mean, he waved goodbye to JJ Redick when JJ fouled out. He was mocking Jimmy Butler for his flopping attempts. I don't know. He seemed extremely comfortable in his first postseason action. And I think, obviously, as you mentioned, inefficient performance. I think that will get a little bit better as the series goes along.
So we've got game two coming up now back in Philadelphia, of course. The adjustments are going to have to come from both sides here. You know, how are you feeling? Do you think that the Nets matching up against the Sixers is going to lead to another Nets victory here? How optimistic are you? Or do you think that there could be a real turnaround? Or is a lot of this just going to depend on Embiid's health? Because he played, but he played only 24 minutes and still dropped 22 and 15 in that time. And if he plays the 30, 32 minutes that he normally, 34 minutes, 35 minutes, then maybe things change. How are you viewing that sort of part of the matchup?
Yeah, I think that when you look at game two, I would be shocked if the Nets were able to take it, just because you look at the Sixers, their top line talent is ridiculous. And you have to think that Brett Brown's going to be able to make at least some adjustments to devise a bit better of a game plan, whether that's kind of balancing Simmons and Embiid more and saying, hey, Simmons, you're going to play your minutes with Mike Scott. But even though Embiid only played 24 minutes, I thought he was still a net positive, just being able to draw so many fouls. Obviously, his shooting wasn't very efficient, but Boban did a really great job as his backup. And I think really the problem was with Ben Simmons, with Tobias Harris and JJ Redick, those complimentary guys couldn't get going and provide any support to Jimmy Butler and Embiid. But you have to think that at least one of those guys is going to get going. The Nets had a great performance. I just don't know if they can kind of really live up to the complete lack of talent they have compared to Philly and be able to win two games on the road initially.
Well, Vegas seems to think that the same here. The Sixers 7.5 point favorites at this point for Monday's game.
A little high.
Yeah, so we'll see. That might be a little bit high, but again, I think they're just sort of banking a little bit of regression from both of these teams back to what they've done during the regular season. Josh will have it all covered for you over on Locked On Nets, of course. Thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA after a huge game one win.
Josh, I always like talking about a Nets win. Don't contact me if it's a Nets loss, though.
Yeah, no worries. See you later, Josh.
Appreciate it.
And lastly, now we go to Indiana to speak with one of the hosts of the Locked On Pacers podcast. Tony East is here with us. Unfortunately, the Pacers on the losing side of their Game 1 matchup against the Boston Celtics. Tony, it was a slog, 84-74 loss against the Celtics. The Pacers team, who I guess limped into the playoffs, some of the effects of the Victor Oladipo injury really starting to catch up with this team, and it did manifest again here in Game 1. If from a Pacers perspective in this game, is there a positive you can take out of it?
Yeah, actually, there is a little bit. One is just holding the Celtics to 84 points, I think, is a good thing. They're such a good defensive team, obviously, and when you lose only scoring 74, it's hard to look for positives. But holding them to 84 is good. Corey Joseph did a good job containing Kyrie Irving. Pretty much every Celtics star, quote-unquote, struggled on offense outside of Jason Tatum. Al Horford had a great defensive game, but that, you know, that's not what I mean by that. So being able to defend them pretty well is good. If you have just an average offensive game, you score 90 points, you win. And then another one for me is the third quarter was really the disaster. They only scored 8 points in an entire quarter, which that deserves all the criticism in the world. But in the first, fourth, second, and fourth quarters combined, they won the game 66-58, which that's not how the game is played. They lost because they sucked in the third quarter so much, but they did so well in the other three, and their defense was good. There are positives you can take away, but in the aggregate, they were terrible.
I've got another positive I can throw in here now. I just spoke with Josh Bass of Locked On Nets about the Nets victory, and we were talking about the Sixers' struggles from both three and from the free throw line. And the Pacers suffered similar struggles here. They, on their three-pointers, they hit just 22% of their 27 attempts, which is obviously a terrible amount. Six of 27 is not a good amount of threes to hit. But also, the fact that they went 12 of 21 from the free throw line is a disaster. And if you're hitting those and your three-pointers at a regular level, that 10-point margin shrinks really, really quickly. So I'll ask the same question to you that I did ask of Josh in that Brooklyn-Philadelphia series, is that those threes that this team were missing, was it a more of an issue of just shots not going in, or it was under pressure shots or a Celtics defensive scheme causing poor three-point attempts to be taken, or was it just a case of good three-point shooters not hitting their shots?
Yeah, some of it's the Celtics are really good on D, right? I think it's like their fifth year in a row of crazy good three-point percentage defense, but I tweeted in the middle of the game, I don't think I've ever seen so many shots rim out in one quarter or game ever in my life. The Pacers did a good job, especially the first 5 minutes of that quarter. They only scored 8, actually generating pretty good looks. They just didn't make them, and you deserve criticism for missing shots. The sport is making shots, of course, but yes, like you say, I think you can draw positives by saying you were able to generate good looks. Your offense was doing enough to set yourselves up to actually score the points to win. You just didn't do the final part of actually putting the ball in the basket. And getting to the line for 21 attempts is no small task, too. That's a pretty good performance. It's just, you know, you missed 9 of them. All of a sudden, the game is out of hand. Your rotations go a little different. So do the Celtics. It really did change the game. And there was a point, I think there were 3 of 8 from the line, like, those just have to go in if you want to win and be competitive in the playoffs.
Well, when you've got Bojan Bogdanovic and Doug McDermott going a combined 0 of 8 from 3-point land, when these guys are consistent 40% 3-point shooters for multiple seasons in a row, like, that number is not going to stick. It's not going to hold, regardless of how well the Celtics do defend the 3-ball. They're not going to miss 8 shots combined in a game. They'll probably end up taking more than 8 shots in majority of these games going forward. And that 10-point margin, 3 threes, and we're down to a 1-point game there. So that it's, while it seems like it's a disaster, the Pacers scoring 74 points and them getting pretty consistently beaten in that poor third quarter from them as well. A couple of shots go in, a couple of good shooters knock in, and Darren Collison's been like a 45% shooter for about 4 years in a row as well, and he wasn't hitting his threes either. He missed both of his three-point attempts. So, there's a lot that can easily swing around there. We're not, I'm not a Pacers fan, but as a Pacers fan, you're not banking on that being the cure-all to this team's malaise through the end of the season and this first game. Are there any other things that they should be looking at to change, or other things that can maybe be marginally adjusted? You're not the coach of this team, obviously, but what could they do to bridge this gap that appears at the moment?
Yeah, they have to find a way to get their bigs going. Horford and Baines should not substantially outplay Miles Turner and DeMontis Sabonis. Sabonis 3-for-7, 3-for-8, I don't remember one of those. He had 7 points and 9 rebounds. The best rebounder on the team, no doubt, but only scoring 7 points, turned it over twice, had a few fouls. His defense was ineffective. And then Turner, only 5 points, 8 rebounds, 4 fouls. His defense was a little less crisp than it usually is. They couldn't get him going in the pick and pop at all, basically. Those guys have to be better. That's usually where their advantage is as a team, is just in the big man rotation. And then when Thaddeus Young's in foul trouble, he actually played well when he was on the floor. You know, that whole group is usually very good, and none of them were particularly awesome in this game. They have to find a way to get going. Go at Al Horford, make him work, because Horford had a fantastic defensive game containing all three of them somehow. So they're going to have to get the bigs going, and then, like you said, McDermott and Bojan just have to make outside shots. I mean, that keeps you in the game right there. That alters the way you play. That alters your mental state. That gives you confidence. Those guys all have to be better. The guards miss shots, too. They did okay on defense. But pretty much everybody has to play a tick better on the defensive end, and everybody's got to make shots. It seems so simple. And then to make the big guys go better, I would maybe stagger them a little more. I think they played a bit of Sabonis. They played Sabonis and Turner together a lot, which I think they need to do in this series. But I think a little more Thad Young would go a long way.
I have a question for you, Tony. I don't know if you've got the box score in front of you, but I'd prefer if you didn't. How many Pacers players do you think shot over 40% from the field in this game?
Over 40? I know the answer is just Corey Joseph. It's one, correct?
Yeah, or unless you're going to include Aaron Holiday. Aaron Holiday's one shot at the end of the game. But yeah, it is Corey Joseph. He was 5 of 9. Everyone else under 40%, which is clearly never going to win you a game, but also not sustainable. And when your big men, Turner, Sabonis, and Thad Young combined for 6 out of, let me just quickly add this up, 23 from the field, and then Sabonis and Turner go a putrid 2 of 6 from the free throw line, there are things that you look at and go, well, that's never going to happen all in one game together. So there should be some positives for the Pacers. But one last thing I do want to talk to you about, Tony, is this team, since the Oladipo injury, they did tend to struggle down the stretch of this year. We saw them going into the playoffs as one of the teams with one of the worst point differentials of playoff teams. Their record was around 500 after that Oladipo injury. They had a little bit of a surge straight after Vic went down, but it did tend to even out. And is that going to be a real problem for them here? Do you think that end of season malaise, the fact that they weren't this strong team, they were more of an average team there, is just sort of manifesting itself now? Is this who they are without their best player?
Yeah, it's interesting. They played a lot of good teams at the end of the year and a lot of lesser teams at the beginning of the year. So not having Vic at the end makes them look 500. But I think it's, a lot of that was also the tough schedule. But at the same time, you play tough teams in the playoffs, so you can take something away from that. I don't know that it's necessarily malaise. They got really hyped up after that Hawks win. They were ready for the playoffs. To me, they came out looking good. Their defense was fantastic in the first half. I just think that they are lacking talent mostly. They don't have their star anymore. They don't have any reliable shot creator who can actually dish to someone else. They have a lot of guys who can create for themselves, but no one who's particularly adept at creating for someone else. So maybe there's a little bit of malaise, or like a little bit of in the back of their head, just like they have no chance. But to me, it's mostly just they're not as talented as the team they're playing.
Yeah, and sometimes that's just all it comes down to. So it is going to be a struggle. I think that they will get a game here off them again with some of this shooting that will regress to the mean from both teams and even things out a little bit. Tony will have that for you all on Locked On Pacers as game 2 tips off in a couple of days' time. And the Pacers fans hope that they can steal one here in Boston. Tony, thanks for jumping on Locked On NBA with me.
Josh, I always appreciate you having me.
And that'll wrap it up for another episode of Locked On NBA. Make sure you are subscribing to Locked On NBA by using the new Himalaya podcast app. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. Follow me on Twitter at @RedRock_Beeble. And you can follow the network at Locked On NBA Net on both Twitter and on Instagram. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.